Gene Homnick.
Hey guys, this is Dennis Kang.
Hey, this is Rashad
Evans. This is David Salvin.
Hey everybody, this is John L. J. Dirksen.
Hey guys, this is Jason the Astronaut.
Hey everybody, you are listening to the world's most handsome fighter on the planet. Yes, this is Al Guapo, and you are listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio with Kelsey Mowat.
The program is Full Contact Fighter Radio, and I am your host from the Northwest, Mr. Kelsey Mowat. Joining me, as always, is my esteemed colleague, Mr. Brendan Lear from sunny, beautiful Edmonton, Alberta. Brendan, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, Kelsey. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And I see...
Have you received any submissions in our fan script, the first 10 minutes contest?
No.
What?
Shockingly, no.
What?
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, buddy. I would imagine any of your Albertan listeners are probably too aghast with sorrow and despair about Premier Ralph Klein. I see you had a tearful goodbye today in your legislature.
I know, it's sad. Looks like no more Ralph Bucks for anyone.
Yes. Sad day for all you Albertans out there, and for everyone else who doesn't know what the hell we're talking about, then it's probably best that we move on. Brendan, we got a big show today. We're going to be talking to Mr. Dennis Kang, fresh back from his huge victory in Pride Bushido last weekend, and we're also going to be talking to one of the United States up-and-comer heavyweight fighters, Devin Cole, who's going to be fighting Alan Goiz, actually, in the IFL next week. So, another stacked show as always.
We got lots to do today. Lots to talk about. UFC, Pride, Bushido, tournament, name it.
Yeah, and it's a crazy month, you know, like, you look at last weekend and you've got two major cards, obviously the Pride and UFC cards. And then, you know, even up here in Canada, there's numerous cards this month in September. The sports, it's just crazy nowadays. You got the MFC next week. There's another new event starting up in Calgary, Bushido Reality Series, Fighting Series, which is mostly going to showcase up-and-coming fighters. But the main event's got Jesse Bongfeld versus Jason St. Louis, which are two pretty good Canadian, Western Canadian fighters. And, we got TKO this month. There's a King of the Cage card in Calgary. And so, you know, Canada, it's busy, busy, busy. And then you've got the IFL. You've got Icon this weekend with Robbie Lawler taking on Jason Mayhem Miller. It's nuts, man.
When it rains fists, it pours.
Exactly. Well, on that note, we should get to it then. We'll come back with Mr. Dennis Kang. And you're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Cage Fury Fighting Championship is coming to Atlantic City Friday, October 6th. This event guarantees nonstop action and a special appearance by Frank Shamrock. The excitement starts the day before at the weigh-in pre-party at the 4040 Club. Don't miss all the excitement. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com or CageFuryFighting.com.
You don't have to be a champion to dress like one. With a Full Contact Fighter shop, we have all the MMA gear that you see so many of your favorite professional fighters wearing. NHB Extreme Fight Shorts, Camouflage Board Shorts, Corduroy and Camo Hats, Hooded Sweatshirts, to the classic FCF T-shirts, Full Contact Fighter Clothing is the number one mixed martial arts brand that any MMA fan must have. Now open is the FCF Sticker and Banner Shop. We have all your favorite IFL team clothing, plus a great assortment of low-priced Pride and MMA DVDs are now all available at the FCF Shop. To check it out, head to www.fcfighter.com, pick up the latest edition of the FCF paper, or call 516-676-0033. That number, again, 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter, the undefeated, no-holds-barred new source of the world.
Hey, this is Mac Danzig, and you're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Joining us now on Full Contact Fighter Radio is Dennis Kang. And Dennis, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, probably not, but I know the win this past weekend over Sulev is a big deal, but, buddy, listen to this. You are joining Elite Company as a second-time guest on the show, joining only Joe Riggs. How about that, huh?
I am honored.
Yes.
I think a calling out of Joe Riggs is in order.
Yeah. You know,
I don't think anyone ever calls him out. So I think when you're done with Pride, you have some business to take care of, and maybe you can reclaim top spot
on UFC and take care of Joe Riggs.
What we should do is just stop having second guests. Just leave it only at Joe Riggs and Dennis Kang now, and then they can have like a
battle it out. It could be the Kang and Riggs show.
Yeah. Battle it out for radio supremacy.
Dennis, then you could go fight in Pride.
Yeah.
And take Dennis' spot.
Yeah, I think I'm right.
And I'll make lots of money by betting against you.
Yeah. You would make a lot of money. Well, obviously the big news, Dennis, is the win over Marasulov this past weekend.
Thank you.
And congrats on that.
Thanks.
What are your thoughts on the fight overall? I mean, I guess really when you look at the fight, did you get a chance to see the replay? Is there anything you would have done?
Yeah, I watched it a bunch of times. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, first of all, you can ask anybody who trains with me will verify this, is I rarely, if at all, train kicks, you know. So, you know, what made me want to decide to throw kicks in this fight, I don't know. I just saw an opening and I started to do it. It felt right, and I saw his eyes light up like, wow, he's going to kick me too now, you know. So it kind of threw a little bit of fear into him, so I kept doing it. And I mean, it worked out great, you know. I think it completely threw off his game plan and his rhythm, so to speak. And I mean, it allowed me to apply my game plan a little bit more effectively, especially when I was able to time his kick and catch it with an overhand right and then take him down to the ground.
Well, that was my next question. I was kind of surprised too, looking at the leg kicks, and I was going to ask you specifically that, whether or not this was like a preset game plan or not, but I guess not.
No, it wasn't. You know, my game plan was to box with him, not kick. If you watch any of my fights, I don't kick that much.
Yeah.
You know, in sparring, I don't really kick that much. Just here and there a little bit. I never practice it, like, you know, on the pads or anything, or in the bag. But I'll do it a little bit in sparring. That's it. You know, but for some reason, for this fight, it just something inside of me, some instinct told me to kick, and you know, it worked. Thank God.
Are you ever worried? Do you ever worry about injuring yourself by kicking someone in a fight?
I know what you mean, because it's easy, you know, with the foot, all the small bones. You kick a knee, you kick an elbow. I mean, maybe that's one of the reasons why I didn't kick so much before. Did I think about that in the fight? Not at all. You know, you don't think that deep in the fight. You know, it's more reactions and based on strategy. So if there was a tournament, I would have been a little bit more conscious of it, I think, because I wouldn't want to injure my foot, for the next round, you know.
Yeah.
For example, in the next fight, you might not see me kick too much in the first round simply because of that factor.
Now, going into that, and Brent and I were discussing this off air, have they announced who you're fighting in the semifinals?
No, they haven't announced. I mean, I think we can pretty safely guess that I'm going to be fighting Gono Ormizakli, simply because those two are on the same team. You know, they're both on Grabaka, and then and they train together. And myself and Paulo Filho are both I'm from American Top Team, and he's from Brazilian Top Team, so it's almost like, you know, like cousin teams. So, you know, we'd rather face each other in the finals, and the same with them. So it makes sense for them, you know, to put us separate in the first brackets.
So I was actually watching the Japanese airing of the Bushido tournament, and on the Japanese show, they actually had you and Filho in the same bracket. They actually displayed the brackets after the tournament was done.
Oh, really?
But you think that was just a graphic?
Yeah, that was just a graphic.
A mistake in the graphic?
Yeah.
So when do you think you'll find out? Pride is notorious for leaving these things to the last minute. When do you plan on finding out?
I don't know. I think I'll find out like in October, you know.
Yeah. And it's stated for November 5th.
It doesn't matter. I mean, there's only three other people left now besides me, so it's a little bit easier to train for it, you know.
Well, when you look at the rest of the field, if you do end up fighting one of the Japanese fighters, how do you think you match up against either one of those guys?
I think I'll match up well against any of those guys, you know, even Filho. But as far as the Japanese fighters are concerned, I think my take on Gono is he's like an old, savvy veteran, you know. You know, in interviews, he's funny. He talks smack on himself. He says, oh, I'm the underdog of the tournament. I'm not that good. I don't know why I'm here, you know. But, you know, I don't believe that. I think he wouldn't have made it this far if that was true. And I think he's kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know. I don't think he's like super dangerous or anything, but he's a lot better than he speaks about himself. And he's very savvy and tricky, and he can beat you in any minute simply because of the fact that you can tell that he keeps a cool head the whole match. Mm. You know,
he's a wolf in disco clothing.
Yeah, exactly. Very well said. You know, and as far as Miyazaki goes. The way I see it for Miyazaki is he's like, you know, a younger,
faster version of Dan Henderson, in my opinion. You know, just a real wild, scrappy guy. Not, you know, nothing too dominant in his style. You know, you can't say he's a grappler, he's a striker. But what stands out the most about his style, I think, is just his tenacity and his you know the way he's really hard nosed about going into the fight.
Dennis, were you surprised? I want to ask you a couple questions about your own fight. But just since you brought up Dan Henderson, were you surprised at Henderson's strategy going into that fight?
No, really, because that's what he's done kind of every other fight for a while now. You know, he's I haven't really seen him utilize his wrestling a whole lot lately. He's just been trying to box with people. In my opinion, that's kind of been his downfall. You know, I mean, granted, he's knocked out a bunch of people. He's got a decent stand-up, but I think if he combined it with his wrestling a little bit more effectively, he'd have a lot better results. You know, and I mean, against Mizaki, he just kind of tried to bang it out and land one big right hand. You know, and Mizaki's got a good chin. He was taking it and beat him to it.
Yeah. Well, Brendan, you said, did you say you had another question about Dennis's fight?
Oh, yeah. We could take turns if you like, Kelsey. But yeah, I'll continue on. So Dennis, my question, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is that now people are watching a lot of your old fights, and now that your reputation is growing, it seems exponentially, and people are talking more about you. It's ironic because Kelsey and I have watched you fight and followed your career for a few years, but now people seem to have the impression that you're this great stand-up guy, and if you go in against Thilo, that maybe you'll be more susceptible on the ground. When in reality, you started your career as a ground fighter, as a jiu-jitsu fighter, and have developed your stand-up game. Do you think people are? What is it like to hear people underestimate your ground game now?
I mean, that's fine. You know, I understand that people are thinking that because of the way my last two fights have played out, but you know. I'm not worried. It doesn't really, like, I don't feel insulted or anything. It's just because of what they've seen, you know. I think it just shows how far the sport's evolved, you know. I think, yeah, I'm a well-rounded fighter, you know, but I don't think I'm anything special because I think that's what every fighter nowadays should strive for. You know, I'm going to be so bold as to say, in the future, all fighters will be like me. You know, well-rounded and doing everything well, you know, which I don't think is too far-fetched because that is what you want, you know, and that is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be, you know, I'm really putting effort into improving my skills in every area of the sport. You know, I'm not just trying to be a grappler or trying to be a striker or, you know, I'm trying to be a good fighter and being able to fight in any situation.
Well, you've gone against three pretty well-known strikers in a row, and against Suloev, I mean, you mentioned earlier that you're planning to box with him a little bit. When you said that, did you mean that you're planning to box with him and look and wait until he's tired a bit to look for the takedown, or were you just looking to try out stand up as long as you could hang with him? Is that basically what your game plan was?
Well, I wanted to box with him to put him into boxing mode so he kind of forget about my takedowns.
Yeah,
because you know, I stood up. Against a lot of fighters, I've done things that a lot of people didn't expect me to. I'm sure nobody expected me to stand up all the way with Semenov or even just to try and stand up with Ninja, you know? So I wanted to kind of confuse him and let him think, okay, this guy's, you know, you see a lot of jiu-jitsu guys get a couple wins with striking and then they forget about their jiu-jitsu and they think they're strikers. Well, that's not me, but I wanted them to think that was me and then I wanted to take him down. I worked on a lot of jiu-jitsu and wrestling for this match.
Yeah.
You know?
Dennis, what was it? Describe the finish of the fight. It was pretty dramatic, but you finished it with a very interesting looking choke, a sort of a single arm rear naked choke. Can you describe the actual technique behind that?
It's to be honest, it's really nothing that incredible in jiu-jitsu. It's a real basic choke. You do it a lot, and you know, it's not a lot to beginners. It's basically just a counter for the counter. When you first apply the rear naked choke and the opponent grabs your arms, well, you trap one of his arms and you can sink the choke in with the remaining arm. But most of the time, it's really hard to do. So I think one of the reasons, one of the things that I had going for me is I think Amar Sula's nose was already broken, and he couldn't breathe through it, and he probably couldn't see very well either. And when it was easier for me to choke him when there was only one airway going back in, you know.
So you think he was ready to go at that time?
I don't know if it's because he was ready to go, but I think it's because he couldn't breathe very well, so it was easier to put that choke on.
With Pride, Dennis, I think we've seen this happen a few times where you've had the current champion in a division, you know, Gomi comes to mind, and now Henderson, where they lose, but they don't lose their belt. Is the prevailing thought, as far as amongst the fighters going, that whoever wins this tournament will have a shot against Henderson for his belt?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, I know you don't want to look too far beyond, you've got a couple tough fights coming up, but what do you think for any of you guys going against Henderson now? Will this change everybody's mindset a little bit, you know, in light of the fact that he's lost?
I think it will. I mean, it definitely... what do you mean? Like, you mean make it kind of less desirable to face him?
Not necessarily less desirable, but, I mean, let's say he had gone through the tournament and won the tournament, and then, you know, someone else had fought him down the road for his belt. You know, let's face it, going into this fight, he was regarded as arguably one or number two middleweights in the world. You know, so now how do fighters look at him having lost?
You know, I think people still recognize him as a viable threat. You know, I mean, he lost, but you got to look who he lost to. He lost to Mizaki, who's one of the best up-and-comers, right? Not up-and-comers, who's one of the best at that weight class. So, and it's not like he got knocked out or submitted. He lost a really close decision. A lot of people actually thought the decision should have gone to Dan. So I don't think anybody's counting him out. I think in that fight, he did show a little bit of age, however, and he showed that he's human, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody thought, oh, he's a guy with the iron chin, he can't be stopped, you know, this and that, but I think he showed a human side in that fight.
Dennis, have you described American Top Team and Brazilian Top Team as being kind of cousin teams? Have you ever trained with Paulo Filho?
I have a little bit. I trained with him about 6 years ago in Brazil, but not extensively. We did a little bit of wrestling training together. I helped him get ready for his first MMA fight in an event called Carlton Gracie's Heroes. And so, I mean, that was the extent of our training. But I watched his training a lot, and he watched me train a lot while I was down there. You know,
would you be apprehensive about fighting him?
No, not at all. I want to fight him. You know,
okay.
It's nothing personal. You know, it's just he's good, and I want to fight him to get to where I want to get to. You know.
So you don't see him having a problem if it breaks down that you both are fighting either Gono or Misaki? Do you think that he could take either one of those guys? Do you expect that he'll be in the final?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, we were a little bit apprehensive of fighting in the first round, but in the final, I don't have any beef about getting it on with him, you know.
Right.
I treat him just like I treated any other opponent.
Well, what do you think about this trend? It seems like now that there's sort of critical masses of fighters training in a small number of camps that big shows draw from, and you see a lot of fighters saying, "Well, I won't fight this guy, I won't fight that guy." Do you in your mindset, the way you set up a fight, do you have animosity towards the person you're fighting, or could you fight a close friend or training partner?
No, I could find. I mean, it depends on the circumstances, I guess. Like for example, for this one, it makes it acceptable because we're both in the same weight class and we're meeting in the tournament. You know, but I could see it happening in other organizations where they don't have the tournament format, and you just meet in the rankings, such as UFC, for example. But, you know, that's a part of the sport. You got to do it. You're friends, but, I mean, you're posting the same jobs. If you don't want to fight each other, then change jobs or change weight classes.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that you got to accept, and you got to remember. I mean, it's not a street fight. You know, it's not country against country in a war. It's just a sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, you're going to fight like it's a war, but it really isn't. You know, after the match, you can shake hands and you can be friends and go have a beer together or whatever you want to do, you know. But it's not, if you can handle that, then that's too bad. And that'll probably be the reason why you lose, you know. But you got to get used to the fact that you probably will compete against people that you know, you know.
Now, we talked about the fact that Dan Henderson, you know, he was regarded, or at least I was mentioned, the fact that he was always brought up as arguably the number one or number two middleweight in the world, 185-pound fighter in the world. And, of course, yeah. Franklin's up there. Dennis, where would you throw yourself in the mix as far as rankings go?
Like a top 10?
Yeah.
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, it's a deep division. I'd put me up there in the top 5 for sure, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think I deserve to be top 5, you know. Which one exactly? Well, I don't know. Maybe at this point, I mean, maybe, you know, 4 or 5, and then after this tournament, number 1.
Who are you picking between Anderson Silva and Rich Franklin, which was just announced just a little short while ago?
Oh, really? It was announced.
Yeah.
You know what?
Well, I believe it was announced.
I think technically Anderson Silva, you know, he's a lot more technical on his feet than Franklin, but Franklin's just so big and dominant. I'm going to go with Anderson Silva.
Yeah.
You know.
Brendan, do you know, was it officially announced, or is that just like a really persistent rumor?
No, it's good to go. It's official.
Yeah, okay. Do you have anything else for Dennis, Brendan?
At least one more question, Dennis. So when you're standing across the ring, looking at Sulov and seeing Fedor behind him, are you glad that you're not actually in professional wrestling where you're at the tag team?
No, I didn't. You know what? I didn't even see him. I knew he was going to be in his corner, but I didn't see him then. I was just so focused, I don't notice that.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that at all. But I saw him. You know what's funny? I was on the way back from Japan to Korea. I was on the same plane with Fedor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he was going to Korea as well.
Oh.
That's funny. But, yeah, I didn't notice Fedor in his corner. I just saw him after. And I was like, oh, cool. Because Fedor is like my hero, man. You don't understand. I look up to the guy so much. I study all his fights. I try to fight like him and everything, you know. So I met him a little bit there in Japan, and I was like a kid and didn't know what to say. So I'm kind of stupid, but, you know.
Well, I mean, you talk about looking up to someone. I mean, what's your status now as far as, you know, being recognized in Japan? I know you've had some tremendous success in Korea on their Spirit MC cards.
My success, as far as recognition, it's grown tremendously in Japan,
yeah.
Especially after this fight. Now, people are recognizing me on the street in Japan where they weren't before, mm-hmm. You know. So it's going in the right direction. You know, I think after this tournament, it's probably going to grow even more. And I mean, I think I'm going to be fighting in Japan for a long time, so... you know, people are starting to take notice and things like that. So I don't know if we'll ever see it come to a point where it's as big as Korea. I hope it does, but until then, you know, it's still growing steady.
Yeah.
So are you interested at all in coming to fight for Pride in North America?
Yeah, of course I am. You know, after this tournament, I'd love to do so. I haven't fought in the U.S. in a long time, you know, so. It'd be great. I mean, I hope that the rules don't change too much, and I'm pretty sure that this show will be successful here anyway. So I think, you know, definitely next year maybe or something like that, they'll probably have me out fighting.
Maybe you could avenge your last loss, which was many years ago now, to Jason Mayhem Miller, who's also on the rise and mentioned as a top 5 fighter in your weight class.
Yeah, you know, we could do that for sure. I think he's with WFA now, though.
Yeah, he's signed with WFA, and he's fighting Robbie Lawler this weekend in the Icon in Hawaii, so it'll be interesting to see who wins that.
But you never know, man. You know how fighters are. They jump ship all the time.
Yeah.
So that's something that could happen.
Well, for a lot of people who probably didn't see this fight, and one of my more memorable fights of yours as far as, you know, back in your career was your fight with Joe Dirksen and TKO. That was an unbelievable fight.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Everybody wants to see that one.
Yeah.
Well,
Dennis, we appreciate you taking some time out. I know you probably haven't been back for too long and running around and talking to everybody and probably have a lot of media to do and whatnot. So we appreciate you taking time out, man, and becoming a
no problem, guys.
Second
time
guest.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to officially call out Riggs right now, we'll spare you a minute.
You know, if I thought, well, I'd have to be a 185, but at 170, I'd be fighting on one leg because I cut off a leg to make that way. You know, I don't think he fights at 185 anymore anyways. So.
No. Alas, no. Brendan, you
try
again.
He's lucky, because if he was, bad news.
Brendan's taking on role of hypothetical matchmaker. He also tried to get Frank Mir. Actually, did get Riggs to call up Frank Mir. So.
Oh, really?
To get Riggs to go up to 250 and then...
That'd be fun, getting up to 250. movie.
No, too bad. It
not many people know this about me, but I'm actually Joe Silva's illegitimate son.
Yeah.
So I come by it honestly.
One of his many.
All right. Thank you very much, Dennis. We appreciate it.
No problem, fellas.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Mixed martial arts legends collide at the Midwestern debut of the International Fight League, Saturday, September 23rd at the Mark of the Quad Cities in Moline, Illinois. See the wildest International Fight League team competition yet as the Quad City Silverbacks defend their home turf against the New York Pit Bulls. And be there to witness the return of hometown hero Pat Milicic as he squares off in a fight to the finish against Jiu-Jitsu master Enzo Gracie. 11 total fights, including Quad City taking on New York and the San Jose Razor Claws, led by Frank Shamrock, battling the Toronto Dragons, coached by Carlos Newton. Plus, the historic super match of Milicic versus Gracie. It all happens Saturday, September 23rd at the Mark of the Quad Cities in Moline, Illinois. Tickets start at $28.50 and are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Or charge by phone at 563-326-1111. That's 563-326-1111. The International Fight League. Pure sport. For more information, go to IFL.TV. Cards subject to change.
Have you subscribed to Full Contact Fighter? FCF is the undefeated, no-holds-barred news source of the world, and no avid MMA fan should ever miss an issue. For years now, FCF has been providing MMA enthusiasts in-depth coverage of the world's greatest sport. Each issue contains event reports and photos from across the globe, including coverage from Japan, Brazil, Britain, Canada, and the United States. From fighter bios, technical advice, to training tips, FCF is the only publication that brings you all the MMA coverage you need every month, 12 times a year. Check out www.fcfighter.com for subscription information or call 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter, the undefeated, no-holds-barred news source of the world. Joining us now on Full Contact Fighter Radio is Mr. Devin Cole. Devin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks. Devin is fighting Alan Goas next Saturday, September 9th, in Portland, Oregon, at the upcoming IFL. And Devin, as you just mentioned earlier when we were off the air, you're at Team Quest today, training.
Yes. I'm getting ready to move up here and start taking this fighting thing serious. I've been doing pretty good winging it so far, so ready to take it the next step and make this my career.
Now, you've had a couple fights in the IFL now, and you were formerly a member of the Tiger Sharks, so, and now you're fighting with Wolfpack, who's coached by Matt Lindland. So what made you make that determination to switch teams and make the move to Team Quest?
Well, I've trained at Team Quest for pretty much all my other fights. Whenever I'd get ready for a fight, I'd leave home in Medford, Oregon, and come up here and train for, 2-3 weeks before the fight, just kind of fine-tune. So when the Portland Wolfpack got a team, when Matt got a team here, it was just logic, sense, and thus, Murray Smith was the head coach of the Tiger Sharks up there, and we kind of bumped heads, we didn't get along very good, so even if Portland wouldn't have got a team, I would have been leaving the Tiger Sharks, so.
Now, is that, I understand you probably don't want to get too much into that if it's a personal thing, but if it was an MMA thing, is that has something to do with, you're usually kind of known as a ground fighter, a strong wrestling background, at least in the fights I've seen and reports I've read on your style. Did that contrast with Maurice's approach to the game, which is usually more striking?
Well, yes and no, because, my weak spot is obviously, my stand-up game. So I was actually looking forward to gaining a lot of knowledge from him on my kickboxing. But, I didn't feel like I was learning anything from him. I didn't agree with his training strategies or anything. So it wasn't a good spot for me. So, I decided to come here and pursue it, other avenues.
Right. Now, you're going to be taking on Alan Goas, who's only had one fight in the last couple of years. He defeated Chris West by knee bar last year. Did you have any chance to look at that tape, or are you basically going on Alan's earlier career, which was, fairly significant?
Yes, well, I actually have never seen Alan fight. I've heard a lot of stuff about him. I know he's a great, great submission guy. I'm just looking forward to going out and fight my fight. My one loss is to Jeff Monson, and I learned in that fight that I didn't fight the way
I tried to change my strategy. I tried to adapt the way he was going to fight, and, you know, when it went to the scorecards, I didn't have enough of what I was doing. So I vowed then to never, you know, really change my strategy. I'm going to fine-tune here and there, but I'm going to go fight my fight and, you know, go win it the way I know how.
Now, against someone like Allen, I'm taking it that you're probably going to try to take it down, stay out of his guard as much as possible. He's, you know, renowned for some fairly significant submission skills. Are you looking to just kind of ground and pound this one out and stay out of the submissions, or are you going to try testing the stand-up?
Well, you know, I'm a wrestler by background. You know, I'm just going to go out there, fight my fight. And, you know, it's hard to get submitted when you're punching the guy in the face. You know, that's what I've always been told. I've learned that is, you know, you can try and armbar me, but it's not going to be very easy if I'm punching you. So I'm just going to go out and try and fight my fight, and, you know, just watch out because he is very slick, and I am going to have to be very careful, but I'm going to go out there and win.
Now, you mentioned your record. You got a pro-am combined record, if you look at the Full Contact Fighter database, of 12-1, which is very impressive. Where would you put Allen against, you know, you've got notable wins against Travis Youf, Mike Kyle, just to mention a couple, and your only loss coming to Jeff Munson, who's, you know, many would say is the number one contender in the UFC heavyweight division right now. Where would you put Allen as far as the rank of opponents you've taken on so far, Devin?
I think he's up there, you know. He's not the stand-up fighter that Mike Kyle was, but he's definitely makes up for it on the ground. I think he's a Gracie back belt or something. I mean, you can't take him light. He's up there, and everybody I'm going to fight from now on, making my name for myself, is going to be, you know, world-class athletes. So I'm just looking forward to, you know, fighting him because I know it's going to be a great battle, and I'm going to be tested, but I'm going to come out on top.
Now, with your wrestling background, you're mentioning that's kind of, you know, what you like to go to. Do you have collegiate wrestling experience, or is it mostly through your training with Team Quest over your career? Or tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into mixed martial arts.
Well, I started wrestling when I was eight, then actually went to college at Southern Oregon University. And after I was an All-American there in 2001, and then coached there through 2003, and Mike Whitehead, who a lot of people know from The Ultimate Fighter, came in, and I actually was his wrestling coach in 2002 and 2003.
Okay.
And he just kind of got me started from there, you know, being his wrestling coach. And he talked me into going into a submission wrestling tournament, and it just all grew from there, you know. And I've been real, real lucky, so, you know, I'm going to keep doing it.
When you look around the rest of the IFL, you, of course, fighting in the heavyweight division, and, you know, there's some notable heavyweights, including, I think, probably one of the most recognizable names for MMA fans would be Ben Rothwell. Do you look around the IFL right now and kind of scope out who you might end up against, or are you basically just looking at one fight at a time and concentrating on your next and most immediate opponent?
You know, I know I'm going to end up fighting Ben Rothwell down the road, you know, so I'm looking at that right now. I was actually supposed to fight him in my last fight on June 3rd in Atlantic City in the finals when the Tiger Sharks and the Silverbacks were paired up. But
right.
He had a back injury, and Travis View, you know, stepped up and moved up a weight class and fought me. So I was looking forward to that fight because me and him both are up-and-comers. And in order for me to, you know, keep moving forward, I'm going to have to beat the best heavyweights out there, and I feel like he's one of them. So I was really looking forward to that fight and looking forward for a good fought win. So I, you know, I am looking forward to that down the road also because I definitely want to beat him.
Now, Devin, we had Matt Leland, your coach, on the show shortly after his WFA fight against Quinton Jackson, and we got to talking about the heavyweight division and why we got to talk about that. It kind of eludes me now, but we're discussing the fact that, and Matt was kind of putting forth the idea that you know, it seems like in our society, at least North America, a lot of the bigger athletes usually end up playing basketball or football, and then for that reason, there's kind of you know, most people say not too many notable heavyweights out there, and that the other divisions are more stacked. Do you agree with that, Devin? Do you think that that's part of the reason that MMA, perhaps, arguably, of course, maybe doesn't have the depth in the heavyweight division that you might see, like, in the lightweight or welterweight divisions?
Well, you know, there isn't the depth. You know, you got a lot of people moving up to the pro category that really shouldn't be there nowadays. But then again, there's nobody there, so they do. I mean, there's a big jump from, say, you know, the top 20 in the U.S. to the top 50. I don't know what really, you know, why that is. It could be, you know, that they focus on football or whatever, but, you know, if you're an athlete, you're an athlete, and you're going to pick this stuff up. I just, you know, really want to, you know, just keep beating the best people out there. I don't care if they're a basketball player, football player, wrestler, whatever. If they come and do mixed martial arts, I'm gonna fight them. I'm gonna beat them.
Right. Now, looking at the UFC and mentioning the fact that that's probably how we got into it. If I remember now, with Matt, I was discussing the UFC heavyweight division. And you look at it right now, it pretty much looks like you've got Tim Sylvia and Jeff Munson, and then, you know, I've got the performances of Congo, Lele, and a couple other guys that looks like they're grooming. But generally speaking, I think most MMA fans and writers would say that that division is probably or maybe the thinnest in the UFC right now. Devin, are you looking towards getting in the UFC? Is that your ultimate goal, or are you just kind of taking one fight at a time and working through the IFL right now?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's everybody's dream from when they start fighting to make the UFC. You know, that's been the big show for so long. But I think the IFL is going to be just as big, if not bigger, hopefully. I actually got offered, after my win over Travis View, I got offered a 3-fight contract from the UFC and turned it down just because, you know, the IFL is treating me so well. And, I mean, I can't say enough about them. Kurt and Garib are, you know, they're the CEO and president of the IFL, and they are amazing guys. And it's almost like the attitude of, instead of what can you do for us as a fighter, what can you do for the show? The IFL is like, well, what can us as a show do for you? And I mean, I can't even say enough about how they've treated us. And I mean, we're truly number one to them. Not to say down the road, I wouldn't like to fight in the UFC. I honestly, truly believe, you know, my one loss is to Jeff Monson. I believe I can beat him if we were to fight again. I lost a close decision to him. Tim Sylvia, I know I can beat him. I think I could be the UFC heavyweight champion right now. But, you know, that's down the road. I don't even know if I'm ever going to cross that avenue. I just really got to, you know, weigh my options and see what's best for me right now. And, you know, in a year, whatever's best for me then. I just got to, you know, I'm married. I got to support my family and see what brings the paychecks in. But, you know, the UFC is wide open. And I think I can make a huge impact in it in my first fight.
No, I know you probably don't want to get too much into, you know, contractual discussions, etc. But, you know, talking to other fighters who have been involved in the IFL and some of the coaches, etc., and a lot of them, you know, point out the fact that they have a salary, that there's incentives, you know, team bonuses, personal bonuses, etc., which, you know, it's not a huge sum of money, but it is a reliable source of money that you know that for at least a year you're going to be probably okay. Is that part of the reason that some of these guys now are looking towards the IFL and that kind of contract instead of the UFC, which quite typically for beginner fighters doesn't offer too much up front, and the allure of the UFC is more for the prestige and possible endorsements?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Like with the UFC, I think the contract they offered me was okay, but I mean, it was a 3-fight contract over 18 months. Say I make, I win my first fight, win my second fight, I'm making, you know, $14,000 per fight. But then, you know, that fight is over, you know, I make $30,000 over, you know, 9-18 months.
Right.
I mean, it's good paydays, but you don't have to fight for, you know, you fight once every 6 months or so. Where the IFL, they do have that monthly salary that you can survive on, you can live, you can just focus and train and make yourself a better fighter. It's just, I, you know, and another thing they're doing is they're giving us health insurance once the full season starts in January, which is, I mean, amazing. I understand how, how they can, you know, give a fighter, a full-time fighter health insurance, but I mean, they are great.
What are your thoughts on the team concept? You've had a couple fights in the IFL now, and what are your thoughts on that? Was it, I mean, you're probably quite used to it, I guess, in a sense, training and and probably cornering, I'm guessing, some of your Team Quest members. But what is it like as far as the team concept in the IFL? Do you enjoy that kind of twist on MMA?
Yes, I really do enjoy it. It's, you know, growing up in a wrestling background, you know, it's you have duels and stuff. So you have your team relying on you already. And that's another thing, like, in my first fight with the IFL, when we fought Gracie's team, the Pitbulls, I was coming off an injury. I popped a rib out 3 weeks before that fight. You know, wasn't in the greatest cardio shape of my life, but it came down to my fight, whoever won the heavyweight fight got to advance to the finals of the tournament. And having my team behind me, I could feel them rooting, them relying on me, helped me pull through. I mean, who knows? I'm not saying I wouldn't have pulled through if it wasn't a team concept, but I know it really did help me. And you also have four other fighters who are training for a fight at the same time. So when you're, you know, going and doing that extra road work, you have somebody you can call who also needs to do it. So I like it personally.
No, like mentioning your team, now you're training with the Wolfpack. Maybe for some of the listeners who might not be familiar with some of the names on the team, who are some of the guys that you're going to be fighting with as part of the Portland team that fans out there should look for?
We have Ryan Schultz at 155. He wrestled for Nebraska. He's really, really tough. He's had a couple losses, coming off a couple losses, but, you know, they've been to real, real tough guys. Chris Wilson is our 170-pounder. I mean, he's actually known as a kickboxer, but I think his last couple wins have been submissions on the ground. Matt Suave Horwich, which, I don't know, have you ever met him?
I haven't met Matt, but I've seen him fight numerous times, yeah.
He's a character himself.
Yeah.
you never know what he's going to do. He's a submission guy, very good. We got Aaron Stark at 205, relatively new to the fighting, a great wrestler. I think he wrestled at Big Ten, Division I school, and then the heavyweight. So we're basically, you know, a core wrestling group, which I think a lot of the, you know, Team Quest guys up here are. But, I mean, we should be really tough. I think we're, you know, my team last year, the Tiger Sharks, made the finals, and I think that we have a better team now, which we're going to find out on September 9th. So, because we are fighting my old team, so.
Now, of course, the main event that night is Matt Lindland versus Jeremy Horn, and this is a fight that, you know, pits two of the best middleweights in the world, arguably, in that fight. I guess my question for you, Devin, is kind of a twofold question. Is one, do you think that this fight is receiving the hype that perhaps it, you know, that is, do you think it's receiving the hype that it probably should, considering the combatants in it? And two, I know you're going to be impartial to Matt Lindland here, but how do you see that fight unfolding?
You know, I think that, I don't think that, when did they announce that fight? It wasn't very long ago, so
it was,
I think,
shortly after the WFA, yeah.
Yeah, they had to wait for Matt's fight in the WFA. So it hasn't got a lot of the hype that, you know, it should have, I don't think. I don't think, you know, there's going to be a lot of people traveling from, you know, the East Coast that say maybe if that fight was in the UFC that they would fight, you know, come watch it,
right,
in Vegas or something. But I think the IFL is kind of more focusing on a local crowd. So in that case, yeah, it's getting the hype, but I don't think it's getting the, you know, the pay-per-view hype that say it should. And then, you know, how do I see that fight going? You know, they're both ground wrestlers or ground fighters. You know, I think if Matt can stay out of Jeremy's submissions, you know, Chael Sonnen just came off a submission loss to Jeremy Horn. And so, I mean, and Lindland was helping him train. So he's got a good game plan for it. I honestly think, you know, Lindland's going to win. He's a very tough guy. I think he'll ground and pound him. So,
My last question for you, Devin, is just kind of an observation that I found. There's been a couple times I've been out and the IFL has been on. We're on TV, as you know, it's shown on Fox Sports News and as well as Sportsnet in Canada. And, you know, it's interesting. I found that sometimes you watch the crowd and they see the IFL on, and the production value of their pay-per-view shows or when they show it on those sports networks is very high, and it's kind of got like a boxing feel to it. You know, like not too huge of a crowd, but nice lighting, and the ring looks sharp. And I often find that people seem to kind of look at it a little bit longer because it's in a ring. And when it's in an octagon, some people, that kind of brings up certain preconceived thoughts and notions that it's a, you know, the violent cage fighting sport. Do you have an opinion as a fighter on whether or not this MMA is better for fans to view it in a ring or in an octagon?
I think for the general audience, the people who are maybe becoming fans for the first time, I think the ring does give it a better, feel for them, just because the cage is actually safer than the ring. Many of the fans don't know that, because you get two guys running across the ring, you can get shoved up out between the ropes.
Yeah.
But then again, the general audience thinks, oh, it's brutal, they're locked in the cage, last one, alive walks out type deal. So I'm actually getting to where I like the ring better. I didn't think that I would. My last, three out of my last four fights have been in a ring. And, it's a lot harder for a guy to stand up in a ring. They can use a cage, a lot easier to get up. So I'm actually starting to like it as a fighter. And for the audience, I guess, the audience, it's first, say if they're flipping through the channels, they come to Fox Sports Network, they'll be probably more apt to watch something in a boxing ring than a cage, just because it does give them the barbaric feeling. I just, hope that people come into the sport open-minded. There's still many, many people out there who think that there's no rules to this sport. And that you can, bite them and eye gouge them and do all that stuff. But I just, hope that people come in with an open mind, and, maybe the boxing ring will help that.
Well, Devin, we appreciate coming on the show and taking some time out of your training, and best of luck as you take on Alan Goaz next week in the IFL, and thanks again, man.
Okay, hey, can I thank a couple people?
Oh, absolutely, go ahead.
First off, Darren, Lucinda, Sparks, I wouldn't be here without them. Their support has helped me train for over a year now, and I wouldn't be at this point if it was not for them. Matt Buffum, and then also all my teammates helping me train for my fight, and most importantly, my wife, Lindsay.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You're listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network. And now, from his upscale 300-square-foot igloo in the trendy Icefield district of Vancouver, British Columbia, he knows what he's talking about. Here's your host, Kelsey Mowat.
Welcome back to Full Contact Fighter Radio. And Brendan, as we get ready to set sail on another episode of Full Contact Fighter Radio, I make it sound so poetic. Another good show. Dennis Kang, some interesting comments, and Devin Cole as well. But, going back to Dennis Kang and his performance pride, show 12, we both picked Dennis to win. And let's quickly go over our picks for this last week. It was a busy weekend. And as far as the pride show goes, I think the only fights that we didn't make picks for every fight, but I know for sure the one that we were both wrong on was Dan Henderson versus Misaki, and I believe also Jason Black losing as well. Neither one of us picked that.
You watched the American version of the show. I watched the Japanese version.
No, I didn't see it, man. I was in Calgary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't get to see it at all. I saw Dennis's fight, or I heard a lot about it, wink, wink. And I saw Dennis's fight, but that was about it. So, actually, I saw Jason Black, too.
What are your thoughts about the poor performance by the Americans?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess it was kind of a surprise, but, that's kind of, when you look at Dan Henderson versus Misaki as an example, and I didn't see this fight, so I can't really comment, but even their last fight, he was given a unanimous decision, and I thought that was kind of generous. I thought their first meeting was pretty close. Misaki really impressed me, but of course, I still picked Henderson to win, but I can't say, him losing was a huge, huge shock, but I was pretty surprised at Jason Black. With his loss, that kind of surprised me, because that guy's been on a tear for so long, and Haoki really demonstrated some pretty sweet submission skills in that fight.
Yeah, there were a couple of interesting things in that fight for me. First of all, Jason Black came in with an Ernie and Bert t-shirt, which is pretty cool. and Aoki was wearing a pair of, there were some interesting apparel choices. He was wearing a pair of sort of almost tights,
yeah,
like Randy Couture used to wear. And there was some controversy surrounding that, because obviously if you're wearing some kind of pant, it's much more difficult if you're slippery to slip to muscle out of a triangle choke, right?
Yeah.
So there was some controversy surrounding that, and it'll be interesting to see if more fighters adopt those. And the Black fight was Black just didn't look like he was there. It didn't look like he was in the triangle for quite a long time, and it didn't look like he was prepared to fight his way out of it. Curran, kind of a disappointing defeat. Brennan, I think the most upsetting wardrobe. I don't want to say it was a malfunction, but of course Gono came in his disco pants and had a pretty sweet dance at the beginning. But the party pants he was actually fighting in. Poor Musasi. At some point in the fight, they got into a north-south position, and it was one of the most brutal teabaggings I've ever seen in MMA. It was just horrific. So I wasn't surprised that he lost after that.
Yeah, well, sounds like I'm kind of glad then that I didn't have to witness that. I wasn't really surprised about Cowagiri beating Brennan, though. I mean, Brennan's a tough fighter, don't get me wrong, but Cowagiri is one of the better Japanese lightweights out there. So that didn't shock me too much.
Well, I think it was refreshing to see a lot of Japanese fighters be dominant in this show, because I know they've always yearned for a champion, and Gomi was sort of satiated that desire. But it's nice to see some of the Japanese fighters really coming into the fore now and demonstrating their dominance in these lightweight categories. So we should see a lot of great. A lot of great crossover between the lightweight Americans and North American fighters and the lightweight Japanese. There should be a lot of fireworks there and in shows that Pride puts on in North America especially.
Well, so what's your take on this then? After talking to Dennis, he maintains that it looks like Dennis and Paul Filho will be fighting one of the Japanese fighters remaining. And what's your take on this? Do you think that there's this, pretty much certainty then that you're going to have Filho versus Dennis Kang in the final?
Well, the Pride has traditionally set up their brackets so Japanese fighters advance. They have they have certainty that Japanese fighters advance. And on the Japanese airing of Pride, on the Japanese broadcast, they had a graphic which had tournament brackets, and actually the next bracket was Kang Filho and Gono Misaki.
Yeah.
Now that was their graphic, and Dennis claimed in his interview that's not the case. But that would be, I'm sure if they weren't from the same team, that would be a certainty that they would the two Japanese would fight one another. But I guess it will depend on how willing the Garabaka fighters are to fight one another. If they're still in the tournament together, then they have to at some point. It's a possibility. But will they want to fight each other in the first round of the finals, or will they be determined to wait till the second? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I know what you're saying as far as the way that they usually line up the brackets and try to get a fan favorite in the final, and of course the event being in Japan, the Japanese fighters are the fan favorites. But you have to look at it. It's if Gono Misaki fight. It could be almost anticlimactic, and I don't want to take anything away from Gono, especially Misaki. I mean, this guy just beat, one of the best 185-pound fighters in the world, so really, I guess I shouldn't take anything away from that. I think Filho versus Kang, whether or not it happens next, or if it happens in the final fight, is going to be a very, very interesting matchup, and, it's... I personally, as much as Kang is on fire right now, Filho is, this guy's never lost, and he just looks very, very dominant right now.
I think regardless of whatever happens, these guys are going to fight.
Yeah.
Regardless of the brackets, these guys will fight. So I think that's what we have to look forward to, either in the first round of the finals or in the finals. I think that's a done deal. I'd be very, very surprised if Gono. If Gono or Misaki could advance through either of those two fighters.
And then UFC 62, of course, which was Saturday night, and our picks, again, we pretty much had complete agreement between the two of us, except for Stephen Bonner versus Forrest Griffin. And I took Stephen Bonner, and you took Forrest Griffin, so you've narrowed the gap between us. I believe now it's 3-2 in my favor of the count. And what did you think of that fight? Were you surprised at the end that you had some fans booing Forrest?
I thought it was a fairly boring fight. I know there's a lot of stand up back and forth, but I wasn't particularly impressed with much of it. They seem to be fairly tentative. I know Stephen Bonner claims to have injured himself in the first round, and that might explain a bit more of that. But for two guys who basically needed a win, I think Bonner needed the win more. Bonner didn't display the aggression of a fighter who needed to win, and I think he did.
Well, I think he just looked really nervous to me. That first round, he looked very nervous and tentative, and you could definitely see that. I understand that Forrest Griffin needed to, you know, he, when we talked to him, he said he needed to win, but that wasn't necessarily the case. If you look at, you know, Stephen Bonner, even though he was awarded the decision against Keith Jardine, he lost to Rashad Evans, and, I still look at it as Forrest's performance against Tito, even though it was a loss, was extremely impressive, and I don't think that he really had too much to worry about if he lost this fight. I mean, his next fight coming up, if he had lost to Bonner, you know, maybe there'd be some pressure, but...
Yeah.
Versus with Stefan now, he's lost a couple in a row and hasn't looked impressive. But, you know, that guy still has a ton of skill. And that's the nice thing with the current UFC, and we've talked about this before, is that you have so many cards and events going on now that I'm sure Stefan will be brought back, and he should be brought back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, even though they'd each lost a fight, they were on two different trajectories. You know, Forrest lost to Tito. Stefan lost to Rashad Evans, another reality show guy, and I think if anyone had to win the fight, it was Bonner, and he didn't. So it will be interesting to see what the UFC does with him now.
I think they should match up Forrest versus Rashad Evans. I don't know if they will, but I think they should. You know, I think that's an interesting matchup. Rashad Evans has never lost. You know, I think that would really, if he fights Forrest and Forrest can beat him, then you've really got a case for a contender on Forrest's hand, on his behalf. Not that, you know, he doesn't already somewhat because of his performance against Tito, but
yeah,
I don't know if they'll do that.
Forrest was talking again about fighting Tito again, and I'm actually getting tired of those rematches in the UFC. You know, a rematch several fights down the road, maybe if they're vying for a number one contendership, but right now, I would not want to see that rematch again. So yeah, that's a great suggestion, and I'm surprised that Joe Silva and me didn't come out and think of that, because that would be a nice fight, and I think a tough fight for both guys. And you and I both underestimated Rashad Evans, but he's had some very good outings as of late. So I think that would be a good looking fight.
Looking at our other picks, and now actually, but I don't remember if it was Nick Diaz versus Josh Neer. I mean, because I had to go on I was on holidays for a few days, and do you remember if we knew about the opponent change for Neer?
I think we picked, we both picked Neer, actually.
Did we? Yeah.
And I was going to say that I'm very happy to have been proven wrong in that, because I really like watching Nick Diaz fight, and I have to say that his fight was by far the biggest and most pleasant surprise of the whole night. You know, it was incredibly dominant. He had a really crisp stand up. His submission was looked great at the end, and it was very masterfully executed, and just a very dominant, impressive fight by Diaz, especially taking it within less than a week's notice. It was great to watch. I love to see fights like that.
Yeah, and I'm very happy too, because, you know, as far as, and it's nothing against Josh Neer or being, you know, cheering for one guy more than the other based on anything personal, but I just was glad because, you know, you have Nick Diaz back, who I've always thought is one of the better 170-pound fighters out there. You know, he's lost some tough decisions, but yeah, I was wrong. I mean, he dominated Neer. I think you could also see, though, the evidence of that hand injury that supposedly kept him out of the latest season of The Ultimate Fighter, and that fight with Johnny Alessio that never materialized, because it looked to me like he was pulling his punches a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, yeah, very impressive performance.
Well, Diaz he's not a guy that comes out with huge power shots, and even in his big knockouts, when he knocked out Terrell, the shot didn't look...
Lawler,
it wasn't a ball. Pardon me?
Lawler, you mean?
Yes, yeah, Lawler, sorry. Yeah. When he knocked out Lawler, it wasn't a bomb, you know? It was a very short, nice hook that hit him right in the button. So he's not a big... he's not a he doesn't look like he throws big power shots, but his punches are crisp and had a lot of snap to them, and they were alive for through the whole three rounds. And I could kind of tell on Nir's face in the third round that he kind of didn't want to be there, and he kind of looked like he'd resigned himself. I know the corner was saying you lost the fight, you got to win it now, but he didn't look like he had it in him to win it, and so I think Diaz really took the fight to him in the first two rounds, and mentally he just wasn't there, and I think that submission was a sort of testament to that.
And then, of course, the main event, which was extremely anticlimactic, and at the pub I watched, had to watch the fight at a pub. I was on holidays, and you can almost hear the moans. You know, there was a lot of Chuck Liddell fans in the audience. Obviously, it was like 90% Chuck Liddell fans, and maybe 10% Babalu fans. But even the Chuck Liddell fans, everyone was kind of cheering, and then they kind of went to silence, and they're like, "Oh, that kind of sucks." It was over so quick, and you know, we paid $15 cover charge to watch the fights in this pub, so. Kind of anticlimactic, but you know, what were your thoughts on that fight, Brendan?
It was kind of puzzling to me, you know, because Babalu's he's a game guy and he's got a lot of talent, but the game plan I still haven't heard. I haven't read anywhere or heard any interviews where he was trying to that would sort of justify the game plan and what he was trying to do, you know, and I don't know if he panicked there and started chasing Chuck around the ring, but it was a bad plan. It was a poorly executed game plan on his part, and I don't know. It was just puzzling. It was puzzling to me. It certainly didn't demonstrate any of his talent as a fighter, and he didn't demonstrate any of the tools that got him there, that won him his last fights in the UFC. And I'm almost puzzled by fighters, you know, like Henderson was another great example. We talked about this already. You dance with the one what brung you in fighting. If that's your, if grappling and your ground game is your strength, why would you stray away with that? Why would you stray away from that and play into the other fighter's strength? It makes no sense unless it's some kind of, you know, machismo thing or...
Well, it seems to me like with Liddell, there were some successes against Chuck with people coming forward and being aggressive and trying to tire him out. I mean, Couture did that in the past in their first fight, mm-hmm. and was successful, and Quinton Jackson, you know, with crisp stand-up, firing down the middle, punches down the middle. And then since then, you've had Couture try to do that a couple more times and failed. You had Jeremy Horn, you know, try to pursue Chuck as well and fail. And now it kind of looked to me like Babalu was sort of going that same route, you know, thinking like, well, get at him. Try to get him tired, and then he'll be easier to take down. And, you know, now that several guys in a row have not been able to, even Vernon White as well tried doing that. So there have been several guys who've come with that game plan, and it's not that I'm saying that game plan can't work, but you have to have very precise, crisp punches, you know, going down the middle, stalking Chuck, making him, you know, think twice about how he's going to direct his punches, his counterpunching, and yeah, it just seemed like... Looking back, and in hindsight, it's always 20/20. But I just think Sobral maybe should have, you know, done the opposite and stood there and maybe tried, you know, waiting for Chuck to come towards him and wait for Chuck to overextend himself and then go for a takedown or whatever. But I agree with you; it just seemed like the game plan was not there from the beginning.
Yeah, there was a certain wildness to it that I didn't really understand. I didn't really understand the necessity for it.
And that's the thing, if you look at it, if Vanderlei Silva and Chuck ever fight, and I doubt that's going to happen in the foreseeable future, but if they ever do fight, if Vanderlei is doing that, if he pursues Chuck, and he doesn't punch either, like straight down the barrel, he's kind of got looping punches from the side, if he comes in against Chuck with that same game plan that he often does, I don't think he'll have too much success. I think, you know, he's got to be a little bit more calculating against someone like Liddell, because all it takes is one shot from Chuck, and then it's over, and he saw that again in this fight. But now when you look at the light heavyweight division, I mean, it's got to be pretty, as a fan, it's kind of frustrating because I really don't see any matchups out there that I'm too excited about. Clearly they're going to be looking at Tito, hoping Tito beats Ken, and then they're going to want Tito versus Chuck Part 2. But other than that, I mean, I guess you could have Forrest Griffin in against Chuck. That'd be an interesting matchup, I suppose. But, you know, right now it's pretty thin as far as who can they bring in to fight Chuck.
There's no one that's even really stalking him right now, you know. The only other legitimate matchup I could see is Brandon Vera coming down to fight at 205, but Brandon Vera is not going to come down and wait until he loses a heavyweight.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon. And I don't know. You know, the only fighters I could see giving Chuck a huge problem are, you know, fighters that are coming up. Either I don't see Quentin Jackson giving him a problem anymore either. Not that he's available. You know, someone I think in Pride, Vandalay is not the guy that would give Chuck problems. I think it would be someone more like Arona that would give him problems. The only other person I could see them maybe bringing in would be someone like an Alistair Overeem. You know,
yeah.
who's a Pride fighter, but has
Chuck
had a couple losses in Pride.
Chuck beat him before, but he was giving Chuck a lot of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Chuck didn't look too good in that fight.
No.
And he did win by knockout, but he was not winning the fight up until that time. So, and I know Overeem's much, much different fighter than he was at that time as well. So I would like to see a fight like that. And I think the UFC is going to have to spend some money right away because they're now basically empty at heavyweight and empty at light heavyweight.
And I agree with that. And I think part of the reason that this is we're entering a new age of mixed martial arts in the sense that the UFC for a long time has been able to sort of put to the fans who they wanted, market it, fans bite, you know, they grab it and they say, okay, this is going to be an interesting matchup. And that's a lot of credit to the UFC marketing team, and I'm not criticizing them for that necessarily because that's what you're going to do. You want to sell pay-per-views, you want to sell tickets. But I think now with the growth of mixed martial arts and the fact that you're going to see the IFL, you know, in the States, you're going to see the WFA, people are going to be watching more cards, more cable network sports channels are picking up coverage, Pride's coming here now, people are seeing Pride fights, that I think now the majority of the fans are going to start to demand that of the UFC. And I don't think they're going to be able to get away with, you know, pushing opponents on against their champions that aren't necessarily viable challengers. And I think you're starting to see that already. And I think it's a good thing. So I agree with you. I think they're going to have to go out and spend some money and take a look around and see who they can bring in or you know, try to open up negotiations again with Pride and get some legitimate challengers, not only for Chuck, but also for Tim Sylvia. You know, Jeff Monson's going to fight him, and that's going to be an interesting matchup. But outside of that, you know, it's getting thin as well, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess they've been basically playing around with three and four fighters in a division and spreading these contests out over 2 years. But even bringing in, I think the UFC is stuck between a rock and a hard place because even bringing in a world-class fighter, do they even have time to build him? So Anderson Silva is getting his shot against Rich Franklin. Is Anderson Silva built up enough, you know, to make that a marketable fight? I'm not sure. I would argue he's not yet in the States built up enough to make that a marketable fight in a big event, even though Anderson's is a legitimate challenger for Franklin.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So
it's going to be an amazing
fight. You have to bring in guys and then sort of build them up over a period of time, so you can't bring in a Ricardo. So you imagine that. You bring in Silva, you bring in Ricardo Arona, they can't fight Chuck right away because no one knows who they are. And that's an ironic, sort of sad truth. But I think it's the truth. It's the truth anyway. Could they market a Silva Chuck Liddell fight in the way they did Randy Chuck? I don't think they can.
No,
not even close.
But I think it is changing, though. You know.
Yeah, it's changing, but I think
not
it's changing slowly.
Enough.
So
yeah.
How would you? The question is, how are they going to build? How are they going to bring in legitimate competitors from outside of their stream, outside of their talent stream, and then build them up?
Well, only time will tell, Brendan. And speaking of time, ours is just about run out. So. Time to wrap it up. Another edition of Full Contact Fighter Radio, and we'll talk to you soon, Brendan.
Have a nice weekend, Kelsey. Take it easy.
You, likewise, buddy. Likewise.